Well, it's fantastic to have Gavin Peacock on Deeper Into the Word. Gavin is well known to a lot of you for his playing days in QPR, Newcastle and Chelsea, as well as other teams. And for some of you younger viewers, you will possibly know him as a pundit on Match of the Day and Football Focus. Gavin has over 500 appearances and over 100 goals as an attacking midfielder, and currently is serving as a passer in Canada. So Gavin, thank you for joining with us tonight.
Real good to be with you, Keith.
So Gavin, as a former pundit, give us your thoughts on the England Euro 2020.
I thought it was a great performance overall from a young, talented team. I think we've become a good tournament team now. And then people say we were on the right side of the draw. And well, that's true. I think you were on a good side of the draw, but you still got to beat what's in front of you. You still got to get out the group stages and then through the knockout stages. And good tournament team. And all the way to the final. I thought Italy were the better team on the day and overall the tournament, a very good team. And Gareth Southgate came under some criticism for maybe not taking a few more risks going forward, which I can see. Maybe he needed to bring on Jack Grealish or Foden or both of them a little bit earlier in that match to kind of change the momentum. At the same time, you're playing Italy, and actually Italy renowned over the years for being very defensive, quite boring. Even with a plethora of great attacking talent, they remained very cagey and ended up winning tournaments. So it was tough, and obviously a tough way to go out with the penalty shootout. So overall, I think encouraging, because you've got to say that the last two tournaments was the best we've done since 1966 when we won it. Semi-final of the World Cup and the final of the Euros, and I'm looking forward to the next World Cup and seeing what we can do in that.
Certainly, the prospects are looking pretty good, Gavin. And throughout your career, you sort of were touching the England squad at times. And I was chatting with a couple of friends and said, the best England team never to get picked for England, where he thought Gavin Peacock would be there, probably centre attacking midfielder. But as we also think about the Euros, Gavin, there was a lot of talk about the racism that some of the players received. As a player, do you ever come across any of that? Did any of your team come across it? And just where do you think racism keeps on raising its ugly head, particularly in football?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real shame to see any kind of racism in any walk of life. Of course, nowadays with the social media and this kind of stuff gets broadcast very quickly, and it creates anger and a momentum and a furore very quickly and of course people can post stuff online now in an anonymous way. They are very brave behind a computer screen and say certain things they wouldn't say face to face. It was a shame because it was a great performance from the England team, and that it's marred by a few, but it's still something that needs to be addressed. Why does it happen? Because it happens because of sin. Because the root problem isn't racism. It's sin in the hearts of man, and that pride that would elevate itself over another because of the color of skin, ethnicity, and what have you. As a Christian, we need to educate people on the evil of racism and how you might deal with it. But to get to the heart of it is heart change in a person, and that's what the Christian faith obviously is all about. It's a new you. It's a heart change. It's treating people created in the image of God respectfully, and that's where you'd put it to death. Otherwise, you'll get over the years, there'll be ebbs and flows, and there'll be times where it's bad and times where it's got gets a bit better, but it'll always be there to some degree.
Yeah, and we're going to get to the heart change that you have encountered, and you do talk about it in your new book called A Greater Glory from Pitch to Pulpit, and really fascinating read, and would encourage anybody to get hold of a copy of it and to share it. But Gavin, let's rewind and talk about growing up. Where did your love of football come from, and tell us about just growing up in England?
Yeah, I grew up in a footballing family. So my dad, Keith, was a professional footballer for Charlton Athletic for 17 years in the 1960s and 70s. In fact, he's the player that played most outfield appearances for Charlton in their history. One club man, captain of Charlton. And so I grew up around the dressing room and the valley there, going down to watch the team, and I knew the players. So, you know, I grew up in a loving home where I had a great mum and dad and my sister. And then the example of my dad and the encouragement of my dad helped stoke in my heart a love for the game myself. And, you know, I think I was a good player as a youngster, but not the greatest, but a good player. And then I just, you know, developed through the stages. And I think with a combination of some talent there, but a real dedication and good character, you know, I was able to sort of come through the ranks to be a promising young schoolboy. I played for England schoolboys when I was 15.
Yeah, so obviously you achieved probably a boyhood dream to represent your country at underage level. Mm. That was obviously after some time in the US that you talk about as well in your book. Again, interesting, something that I didn't realise before reading it. But tell us about then your first club appearance and how did that all feel to get signed and then to get into the first team squad. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you know, I left school at 16. You know, I finished my GCSEs and signed for Queen's Park Rangers. I chose to sign for Rangers. I had the options of Liverpool and Arsenal, Tottenham, but Rangers were in the top division and slightly smaller team as well than those others, and a chance of coming through a bit earlier. And Terry Venables was manager, obviously young, bright manager. They played on a plastic pitch there, the AstroTurf, first AstroTurf pitch in the league. But a good reputation for bringing young players through. And so I signed. And of course, you know, a lot of people think, oh, once you've signed, you've made it. Well, no, that's just the hard work's just beginning. So it was a matter over the next couple of years of really becoming a professional footballer. It's business now. You know, it's full-time training. It's agonizing training. It's hard work mentally and physically. You're in a man's world, and it's cutthroat to a great degree as well. And so over the next couple of years, it was a matter of playing for the youth team reserves and then making my first team debut when Jim Smith had taken over by that time as manager. And he gave me my debut against Sheffield Wednesday just a few days after my 19th birthday. So it was a great occasion.
Wonderful. Well, as a Sheffield Wednesday fan, that was one of the games that we didn't lose. So
2-2 draw at Loftus Road it was.
Oh, very good. So at this time, you're young, you've got a promising career ahead of you. You learned on something pretty peculiar and you started to investigate Christianity and you became a Christian. Tell us about that journey, Gavin, and what sort of began that within you?
Well, I wasn't brought up in a Christian home. As I say, it was a stable, loving home, but not a Christian home. Football was my God. You know, all I ever wanted to do was play football, following my dad's footsteps. I achieved that schoolboy dream. And yet, when I got the schoolboy dream, because football was my God, if I played well, I was up. If I played bad, I was down. So in those first couple of years as a signed as a pro, I was a bit up and down and thinking, oh, this is what the world says, this will bring happiness, you know, this kind of career, you know, you've got the great career, you've got a little bit of money, you've got fame growing. This should bring ultimate satisfaction, but it wasn't quite. So that was going around in my mind. And I lived at home at the time. And then just one night, my mum said she was going to go along to the local church. As I say, not a Christian, but she's just checked it out. It's the local Methodist church. So I said, I'll keep her company. And afterwards, the minister invited me back to his house where there was a youth meeting, only about half a dozen young people my age there. And I pulled up to that meeting. I was driving a Ford Escort XR3i. It was a proper 1980s sports car. As I said, I'm in the in crowd. I've got a little bit of money. I've got the career. These people didn't have what I had. But when they spoke about Jesus Christ and when they prayed, there was a joy and reality they had that I did not have. And then I heard over the next couple of weeks the minister unpack from the Bible, what is the gospel? In other words, what is the good news of what God has done to save people like me and you and in the life, death, and resurrection of his son, Jesus Christ. And I realized, you know, that God had created me, that I had sinned against this holy and loving God, and that because he was holy, he was to judge my sin, and I sat under his judgment. And yet through his great grace, he sent his son to be a sacrifice for my sins. And I realized that my greatest need wasn't the approval of the crowd on Saturday, but to be in a right relationship with the living God. And that was possible through faith in Jesus Christ. And I believed, and then my whole life changed. You know, I knew my sins were forgiven. I knew I was a child of God. I had identity and purpose. Jesus was God, not football anymore as such. And yet I was able to enjoy football for what it was. I was a Christian first, but God had put me in the field, as it were, of professional football for a time. And my life changed instantly. And then there was that joy, there was that sense of satisfaction, that sense of peace that wasn't there before. And at 18 years old, I was a Christian in the world of professional football.
And how did the lads in the changing room react to it, or how did the player or to the fans in the crowd react, Gavin?
Well, the players, you know, I was honest with the lads. You live with them for 10 months of the year as well. You know, they find out what you do at the weekend. I told them I was a Christian. And there was a mix, I think, of a little bit of mickey taking. It's something new, you know, in the professional football camp. If you wear a new tie into on a match day, it could be, you could find it cut up into pieces afterwards if the lads see it. Anything new is just fair game for a bit of mickey taking. But after a while, I think they just began to respect my beliefs and saw that there was a maybe some kind of walk that backed up the talk. And then I had amazing conversations with players over the years, players you'd never think would ask. So I think it's, you know, it was that combination. And I think people will face that in most walks of life, whatever they do, when they say that they are a Christian. And I think that's where our speech, our presentation as Christians of what the gospel is key, and also our lives and witness to back that up. And you just don't know the effect that you're going to have on people.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll be a real encouragement to people in the world of sport, whether it's amateur, professional, or just social, to do the good words, but also to answer with their our lives as well. And obviously Christians in sport who you were involved with are really keen to help people in the world of sport to do that.
Yes.
It's clear, God, having read A Greater Glory, I got it on Kindle, but it's also available on hardback, I believe, that you're a real family man as well. Tell us how you met your wife and just how your Christian faith has impact in that sphere of your life as well.
Yeah, I met my wife actually, it would be not long before that first team debut, when I was at QPR. I was actually at night school studying history, A-level, in Southeast London, and my wife was in that class, and we got talking at the first break on the evening, and she asked me what I did, and I thought, well, I've got the ideal chat up line here, you know, I'm a professional footballer, must get the girl. And I told her I was, and she said, oh, I don't really like football at all. So God was humbling me. But she was very interested when we carried on talking. I told her I was a Christian. She started to then come to church with me to that youth group. And then long after, she became a Christian. And a couple of years later, we were married. Obviously, asking Amanda to marry me was the best decision I ever made after following Jesus Christ. And I think, you know, that being a Christian shapes the way that I view the family, that the family is instituted and ordained by God from the first pages of Scripture, where he creates the man and the woman and brings them together in a marriage and says, be fruitful and multiply and have children in this one flesh union. And also then how the husband, me as a husband, is called to lead my wife with a sacrificial, protective, and providing example. And Jesus Christ himself is called the bridegroom of the church, his bride. And so he sets the example even of how to be a husband to the bride in the way that he deals with the church. And so my Christian faith then has just shaped completely my family life, and we've two children, and Jake and Ava. Now they're both married, but they're both Christians as well, and they married Christian spouses. So, we feel very blessed. Our marriage is now over 30 years old, and we're still pressing on. And the great thing about Christian marriage is that, you know, you're always growing, you're always going somewhere. It's not a case of flattening, it's or getting stale. It's a case of growing in your walk as a Christian husband, Christian wife, together in this one flesh union that Ephesians 5 says is a picture of Christ and the church.
Yeah, thanks, Gavin. Get back to the football, and after a few clubs, you end up at Newcastle and playing under Kevin Keegan, a team that you supported as a child. Your grandfather was just delighted that you signed for Newcastle. Again, a fascinating couple of chapters in the book. Tell us about playing for Kevin Keegan, a real legend, and tell us about your time at the club at Newcastle. Mm.
Well, Jim Smith had taken over at Newcastle after I'd left QPR and gone on my travels a little bit. I was with Harry Redknapp at Bournemouth, and Jim Smith bought me from Bournemouth, took me up to Newcastle. And it was just, as soon as I arrived there, you know, it was a twofold thing. I knew I was arriving at a sleeping giant, big club. And it was a club that, as you say, I'd supported as a kid. Obviously, I was a Charlton fan because of my dad, but my granddad and grandmother, they were from South Shields. So they were Geordies, born and bred. And first ever kit I got was, even before a Charlton kit, was a Newcastle kit. I used to go there for family holidays, and so signing for Newcastle was a dream for my granddad, you know, that I would pull on that famous black and white shirt. And then after playing for Jim for a little while, Ozzy Ardiles took over. I had some time with the great Argentinian, and he really helped my game in terms of attacking midfield. And then Keegan came in, and he was like a breath of fresh air. Inspirational man, inspirational manager, knew how to make you different players tick just to say the right thing. And he made you believe that you could, you know, we would get promotion to the Premier League. He just made you believe. He bought good players, but he put us together in this unit as a team. And it was some of the best football I've ever played with any of the teams, and that's included Chelsea, when we got promotion to the Premier League. And so, I tell quite a few stories through all the clubs I played for, but of the Newcastle days and some of the stories of what made Kevin Keegan such a great leader. In fact, my book is in some ways a study of leadership. You know, the great leaders I played for, I was a captain and a leader at my teams, and just what it takes to to be a great leader is one of the threads, along with family and all of these other things that, that the book contains.
No, it really has. And we'll talk about Glenn Hoddle at Chelsea. We'll, and even in the BBC, I mean, you serve and you work under some great leaders there as well. And also, you captain QPR, Newcastle and Chelsea. So we'll touch on that just later on in our interview. You've just won promotion to the First Division and current Premiership with Newcastle. And then you and Amanda are expecting your first child. And things take a bit of a twist. How did what happened? How are you coping? How did your Christian faith again impact what was going on in those days?
Yeah, we got promotion to the Premier League, and Amanda was just about to give birth to our first child, Jake. It was a very difficult labour, and 2 days later, Jake was born, forceps delivery, cord wrapped around his neck. He'd been sort of fighting for his life, and then we discovered as well that he had only one hand. So Jake has only a third of his forearm below the elbow. And it was a total shock. We only had one scan in those days, amazingly. And the way he was lying, I think it must have been just didn't show up on the scan on that day. And so you can imagine being the highest you've ever been, then to just be in this, you know, your stomach is turned over, you're reeling from the shock. In those days, you know, we didn't know so much about limb deficiencies. There were other things often attached to a limb deficiency, like brain or heart or lung issues. So there was a series of tests going on. And then, yeah, I mean, moments of crisis, you really find out what you stand on. What is your rock? And, you know, Christ is our rock and was our rock. And then, and, you know, through the words of encouragement of friends around, through prayer, through the reading of our Bibles, that we were, we could be assured that we didn't have all the answers and know why this happened or completely why this happened, but we knew that the God who was in control of all things was good and loving and cared for us. And he'd shown that in sending his son to die for us and rise again. And so we could rest in that hope and in that security. And so that's very much how our Christian faith sustained us in those days.
And it's amazing to read in your book again just what your son's gone on to achieve and his, is it Muay Thai boxing?
Yeah. Muay Thai is a professional Muay Thai fighter in a sport you think you need two hands for. In fact, Muay Thai is called the art of eight limbs. And yet he has one hand missing, but he's a pro. He's just won the North American title. He's fighting in Glasgow next month, actually, 20th of August, I believe. And that will be for a European title. And he runs his own gym in Calgary. But most of all, he loves the Lord and he's a Christian lad. So, yeah, it's amazing how God has worked in his life and shown him grace and shown that, you know, I think he's an inspirational story anyway, as to perseverance against the odds. And he can talk to many people as well and give that perspective about how, before he was a Christian even, he had struggled a little bit with body image stuff, you know, because of his hand and people would look. But now, as a Christian, his identity is not in his body. It's not in being a professional fighter. It's in Jesus Christ. And those other things come afterwards. So it's a good testimony.
Yeah, absolutely. How did what happened to Jake then affect your career on the pitch, Gavin?
Well, Kevin Keegan was brilliant at the time. It was traumatic. He was calling me up, concerned for me, my wife, a baby. And after a little bit of time, we were London people, London folks. I think at some stage we'd have always returned to London, but we wanted to get back down to be closer to family. And I expressed this to Kevin And he was excellent. He said, look, I don't want you to leave. I'm bringing Beardsley in, and you and Beardsley, Andy Cole would go well together. He said, but if your wife's not happy, you won't play your best football. So I won't outprice you in the market. And within a couple of months, Glenn Hoddle had got the Chelsea job. He'd been Swindon manager, got them to the Premier League, got the Chelsea job. And Glenn, who'd been interested in me from his days at Swindon, he called me up and said, I'd like to make you my first signing for Chelsea Football Club. And then it was a no-brainer for me. Sad to leave Newcastle and in those circumstances, because I loved it so much there and I loved the fans and I would have stayed. But just timing in life is everything. And it was the right time for me to go and to join a very big club in London on the cusp of a real turnaround with a great manager.
And tell us about Chelsea before the days of Abramovich. And
yeah,
tell us, I mean, Glenn Hoddle, was he as good as they'll say he was?
Yeah, been better. Keegan called me up after I signed for Chelsea and he said, look, you're going to an equally as big a club. He said, you'll learn more from playing with Glenn Hoddle in training than anything else. By then, and Glenn was only 36. He was in his last year of playing, so he was player manager. So yeah, Glenn was a genius. Of all the players I've played with, I put him down as the best. And I've played with Hullett, Ruud Gullit, and Zola and Viali, Di Matteo, all of these excellent players, but Glenn's mind was on a level that he just saw stuff on the field that no one else saw. And he could deliver passes, left foot, right foot, inside, outside the foot, with just the perfect weight. I mean, it's been said before, if he'd been Brazilian or French or Spanish, he would have had 150 caps for his country because they would have just built the team around him. So, playing with Glenn was a real education on the field. And, he made me a better player in the 4 years, 3.5 years I was at Chelsea.
So playing at Chelsea, probably your highlight of the season, was it 93, the FA Cup final?
94, yeah, 94.
And the year you scored against Man U, home and away.
Yeah.
For everybody out there who hates Man U, it's better. Although for all the Man U fans, we'll say, well, we got the big one that year. But you came within an inch, possibly, of great FA Cup final goal.
Mm.
Tell us about just that experience, even.
Right. So, we got to the first FA Cup final in 24 years for Chelsea. We'd won on a great run. In the FA Cup, I scored in every round. Plus, it was Man United in the final. And you're right, I'd scored twice against them in 1-0 victories during the season. So we did the double over them that season. And even though they were the better team, clearly they'd won the Premier League, we felt we were a bit of their bogey team. And we started the game well. It was a rainy day at Wembley, 90,000 in the stadium. And we were buzzing. And the ball dropped to me about 25 yards out. And I just instinctively flicked it from my right foot to my left and let fly, and I didn't even feel the ball come off my left foot. It was that good a strike. And then it was like, in the first chapter of my book, Greater Glory, is I write about the FA Cup final. It's a whole chapter on that, and it's in the present tense. So I want to draw people into the experience. And it was as if, I write it as if time stands still, and I'm watching this ball fly and it's going over the head of Peter Schmeichel and he's backpedaling and I'm thinking, this is in. Peacock scores again, 1-0 to Chelsea. Man United, they're going to think it's not their year. We'll have one, we'll go in one hand on the cup at halftime. And as he stretched and dived, and I'm just looking, it just hit the crossbar and bounced out. And we went in 0-0 at halftime. And second half was a different story. A couple of penalties against us. And then we started to try and go for it. And they hit us on the break. They won 4-0. But it's just the inches is the fine line between, victory and defeat, between success and failure. And 3 years later, Roberto Di Matteo in the FA Cup final, Chelsea play Middlesbrough, bursts through in the first minute of the game, hits a stunning shot, hits the same crossbar I hit. This time it's an inch lower and hit the underside of that crossbar and it goes in, and Chelsea win their first, go on to win their first silverware and the many silverware to come through that, just an inch lower. But that was part of the turning point, that first season at Chelsea. We're in the cup final. We went on to play in Europe the next year, semi-final of Europe, semi-final of the FA Cup the next year. And bigger players were coming our way as well.
Yeah, and you talk about that, just sort of signing Di Matteo, Fiali, Sola, Hewlett's playing alongside you, then becomes the manager. Things peter out at Chelsea, and you find your way back to QPR, and you find yourself captaining QPR. Hmm. Do you enjoy being a captain at Chelsea, Newcastle, QPR, and what do you learn from these experiences?
Yeah, being captain was one of the great privileges of my career and all the teams I played for. You know, I loved leading the guys, men out into the arena. And I think, you know, to be a captain, you don't have to be the best player. I think you have to be one of the better players, but you don't have to be the best, but you have to be able to inspire those around you with your words, with your example, with your character. And some captains are more verbal than others. I think I grew in that role as well. Kevin Keegan said to me, and again, I write about this in the book, Little Insights. You know, Keegan said to me, when you're a captain, you have to give even more of yourself to the team than any of the other teammates. And I thought, God, that's a lot, because it's enough just to keep your own game together, let alone give even more of yourself to the team. But I began to grow in that, I think, as I grew as a captain and grew in wisdom, really, in dealing with other players and seeing the bigger picture. And so, yeah, as my dad had been a captain, I was a captain and leader of men on the field. And I learned from the great leaders that I played under as well, how to be a good leader on the field.
Yeah, and I think you probably brought some of those lessons off the field as well, even into your church where you pastor in a church, and we'll come on to that. But as we sort of look back on your on the pitch years, what advice would you give to a young sports person watching or listening here? Either somebody who is a Christian or somebody who isn't a Christian, as they are just engulfed in this love of sport, whether it's football, rugby, hockey, whatever it is. What advice would you give to them, sort of reflecting on your own career?
Well, I mean, you know, the great thing is that if you love the sport, that's great. You know, you want to play sport for the love of the game, not for money. If you're good, money might come along and with success and the fame. But do it for the love of the game, and to succeed at the top level, very, very few do. You have to be realistic in that. Very few do. But that doesn't mean to say that you can't try. And it takes a lot of sacrifice, a lot of hard work and dedication. It takes talent, but more than talent, it takes character and resilience. And those are the things that will be tested out if and when you progress through the different ranks. But for me, and really, you know, one of the messages of my book is that, you know, football or sport is great, but Jesus is greater, because he is there beyond sport. We're all ex-sportsmen at some, or sportswomen at some stage of life. And I can't play football now at a professional level. But I'm still a Christian. Christ is still with me. I know where I'm going in life, in the sense of my spiritual life and beyond. And that's the greater glory that things like sport echo, that wanting to praise something that's thrilling and beautiful and excellent, wanting to do it together in a group, a sense of identity, a sense of glory and victory. Is all an echo of what we were made for and made to find in the Lord. And that, that's for me is what I would point people to. And I just say one other thing to young sportsmen or women is to be listening to the advice of your parents and of your coaches, because they've walked the path a little bit longer than you. And anyone that I knew and know that makes a success in sport has been a learner, you know, and has responded well to those who are older and wiser.
No, thanks for that, Gavin. You're playing days come to an end after over 500 appearances and 100 plus goals. You're clearly an intelligent player playing sort of midfield behind the front two. Do you ever consider coaching?
Yeah, I did. My dad went into management, was a coach. Jerry Francis was my manager at QPR for a while, and I loved playing for Jerry. In fact, I always say if Jerry had continued at QPR and my playing days had come to an end, as they did there, and Jerry had said, look, come on board with me, you know, be an assistant coach or player assistant or something, I actually think I might have gone down that route because I had such respect for Jerry. But that wasn't the case. Jerry had left. Ian Holloway had taken over, and he was a young manager. And so I'd considered it. I was advised by Jerry as well, Jerry Francis, to go take your coaching badges. You'll be good. You know, you've led men as captain. You'll be a good manager. And yet the media stuff started to come my way as soon as I decided to retire. And so I thought, I'll just test this out. And it actually went better than I could imagine. I ended up starting again in a new career, but ended up working for the BBC and making it onto their kind of elite team for Match of the Day, Football Focus, Final Score. Ended up going to Euros in Portugal and Switzerland, Austria, and to World Cup in Germany. So it was a thrilling second career, a dream second career, really, that I really loved doing for the 6 years that I did it.
Yeah, and you talked alongside Hansen, Lineker, Shearer, Lawrence, and all the greats of UK broadcasting. But you then took a diversion after those 6 years into a less familiar path for a former pro. What led you down this particular path, and what was it?
Well, I mean, I went into studying for church ministry and into the ministry after that. What led to it was, obviously, I've been a Christian since I was 18, but I'd never really had a sense of a call to church ministry or leadership until around about 2006, the World Cup in Germany. So my career and second career is on the rise. I'm turning down work. I'm starting to present other things. I was presenting songs of praise. They were sort of getting me at the BBC ready to do other roles as such. So my career was on the up. And then my wife, Amanda, got quite ill, and she was in hospital for a while there, and suffering often recalibrates your focus. And I was just spending a lot of time reading the Bible and praying, and I read a portion of the Bible in the New Testament where the Apostle Paul speaks about preaching the word for the sake of the future of Christianity and the great charge that this is. And I thought, wow, that's a great responsibility. And something in me stirred, you know. I did like to that feeling of leading men when I was a player, and I could communicate quite well because obviously I was on the BBC and such. And but that didn't qualify me to be a pastor. You know, the Bible has specific qualifications there that you must meet. But I thought, well, what about if I started some sort of studies in the Old Testament, New Testament, spoke to my church leadership. They recognized certain gifts in me. They said, yeah, go for the studies. We'll give you some opportunities to maybe do some preaching. Meanwhile, I'm still carrying on at BBC. But as I started to do my studies, as I started to do some more teaching formally in the church, it grew in me this desire, this joyful compulsion But not only does this bring me joy, but I must do it, a sense of I must do it. And then I decided, I said to my wife, I think I'm going to give it up, give up the second dream career to take some time to finish my studies and prepare for church ministry. And in 2008, I spoke to the head of BBC Sport and they were quite shocked. I knew people would be surprised and maybe not quite understand it. I could have studied in England, but we'd been coming to Canada quite regularly. And I thought, what would it look like to go to anonymity? My profile was really high in the UK. People might confuse Gavin Peacock, the footballer, or BBC pundit with Gavin Peacock, the Christian. And I'll come here, finish my master's degree, and then we'll go back. Be a good experience for the kids. And it'll be a test of our faith. And so in 2008, we left the shores of the UK and ended up in Calgary, Alberta, Western Canada, Rocky Mountains territory. I finished my studies here in 2011, was looking to go back to England, and I got offered a position as an associate pastor here at Calvary Grace Church in Calgary, where I'm serving now. And God's opened up the doors for me to go and speak globally. I come back to the UK when invited by different churches, probably at least 5-6 weeks a year, and other parts of the world as well.
And do the Canadians call it soccer?
They call it soccer. Yeah, they do. They do. And of course, soccer is just not even for place on the sporting agenda here. I mean, it's all about hockey. And then it will be the American sports, big American sports after that. So I do miss my soccer chat and banter that I had back in the UK. But no, it's been a very difficult last decade, but a very rewarding one.
Yeah. Final couple of questions, Gavin. Really appreciate your time this evening. How would you compare preaching to playing, or even preparing to preach to preparing to play, from walking out in front of 60,000 at Old Trafford to walking out in front of, I don't know what your church is, a couple of hundred?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are differences. I mean, obviously, like, you know, similarities. It's hard work preparing to preach. It's hard work preparing to play. That sort of sense of responsibility, I think, is there when you walk out to preach as well as you walk out to play, to actually, you know, be a person of integrity, and, you know, the fans have paid your wages and you want to give good value. As a pastor, you want to be a man of integrity and give the people the Bible, the Word of God, not your own ideas, for their good, for God's glory. But the difference is that that playing football is for a glory that's temporary, but preaching the gospel is for a glory that's eternal. And that on a Sunday when I'm preaching to 200, I'm dealing with people's souls. I'm dealing with them through the Word of God and in general pastoral life, in the high moments of their lives and the low moments of their lives, walking through them to help shepherd them along the way, at the same time as I'm walking the Christian life. And so it's not the glamorous thing that football is, but it is a very glorious thing. It's a very rewarding thing. And it's a great privilege, and the greatest privilege, I think, that I've had is to be a pastor for as long as that will last.
Thanks, Gavin. And yeah, as I say, I really appreciate your time. And for anybody who wants to find out more, do grab yourself a copy of Our Greater Glory. You can download it from Kindle right now, or you can purchase it from the Avondale Bookshop here in Belfast, or any good Christian bookshop, I'm sure they'll have it. But as we conclude, Gavin, find people who've been watching or listening, possibly love football, possibly Chelsea, Newcastle, QPR, but possibly see Jesus as just irrelevant to them. What would you say to them at the end of this interview tonight?
Well, I think that my book is a story of life in all of its complexity, set against the backdrop of a beautiful game of football, but with the light of my Christian faith upon it. And so what I hope is that there'll be things that people can see during the book that they'll relate to and love football and everything, but points that them gently towards Jesus Christ as not irrelevant, but totally relevant. And even some of the echoes of what they've been looking for in their lives, apart from Jesus, is actually only truly fulfilled in Jesus, that we were made by God for him. And Jesus shows us that we need to be reconciled to God in a right relationship with God. And Jesus is the one that can provide that, that we live this life now, but Jesus provides eternal life now and to come. And so I would say in it all, the greater glory in life, the greater happiness, the greater peace, the satisfaction that everyone wants is only found in Jesus. And, you know, if you think after it all, reading my book or what have you, that it's irrelevant, why not investigate Jesus' own claims for himself and read the Gospel of Mark, which is it's the shortest of the Gospels. The first 8 chapters tell you who Jesus is. The second 8 chapters tell you what he came to do. And sit down and read the claims of Jesus for himself and then decide without just discarding him. And, you know, I'm somebody that's had everything the world says will make you happy. And I've played with some of the greatest talents of a generation and seen how that doesn't ultimately satisfy the great need in us all, but only Jesus can.
Gavin, a big thank you for all that you've shared. And thank you for everything you shared in your book as well. Thank you even for what you wrote in your earlier book. You'll never walk alone, having read it as, I think, as a teenager in the world of sport in the Port of Rugby. Found very encouraging. And just pray that God will continue to bless you in Calvary Church there and your family as well and all that you do in your traveling. So thank you.
Thanks, Keith. Thank you very much.